You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, Burnaby, BC.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints, where local news meets a national audience. On today's show, in Quebec, the Premier's comments made last week cast a shadow over Refugee Day celebrations. François Legault blamed immigrants for Quebec's housing crisis.
Those refugees, asylum seekers, permanent residents, temporary foreign workers, they are the ones that are going to be taking care of the Quebecois. The Canadian later, they will become the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, the future of the country.
A Pay What You Can food market collaborates with community gardens for fresh produce, and it works.
I think we've rescued over 27,000 meals in the last year to rescue meals that would go in the garbage, in the waste, and bring them to our market. So we use food app, Second Harvest. We also just have other community connections, different groups who have actually started reaching out to us to drop off donations, as well as connections with other, you know, grocery stores, farmers in the area who are interested in our program.
And women strike outside the Nanaimo courthouse and across the country to bring awareness about women's rights.
I mean, I've been led by example, and I've certainly been vocal, but I have not been an activist. I have not been someone who's on the forefront, but I really do feel like times are changing and I need to become more so, that we are at a turning point. And so I think it is really important that we do start to stand up and we do start to speak out more publicly.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks for keeping us company. Boris Chassagne here with you for the next half hour. We kick things off in the province of Quebec, where Montrealers celebrated World Refugee Day last week. It was all smiles on Thursday as Montrealers celebrated that day with food, dancing, and info-sharing activities at the Centre Saint-Jacques in the heart of the city of Montreal. But advocates expressed worry and concern about changes in provincial policy toward refugees. Premier François Legault recently announced his intention to halve the number of asylum seekers Quebec takes in, and he has blamed migrants for Quebec's housing crisis. A spokesperson from the Ministry of Immigration did not immediately give comment when reached by a journalist. Jules Bugiel in Montreal, Quebec, is following that story.
Today's heat wave didn't dampen spirits for Montrealers celebrating World Refugee Day. Refugees and organizations working on refugee issues gathered in the Centre Saint-Jacques for food, dancing, and community outreach.
I am Carlos Rojas Salazar, and I am a full-time migrant. I am also the director of Action Refugee Montréal, and this is the building where we work, and we invited 20 organizations to come and celebrate the Journée Mondiale des Réfugiés, the World Refugee Day.
Rojas wants to break down preconceptions about refugees being different from other folks in Canada.
When we get people that are coming from outside, and they are coming to establish, to settle there, in our land here in Quebec, in Canada, they are coming with, they're looking for a better life.
But the experience of seeking asylum is often long and arduous, even after arriving in Quebec. Only a fraction of the tens of thousands of people living with precarious status are granted permanent residency each year. Without PR, asylum seekers and others with precarious status are routinely denied access to services like healthcare.
This morning we had a testimony from a woman who came as a refugee with three kids, and she became an ange gardien, one of those people who risk their lives during the pandemic to care for people from Quebec. She was working 16 hours per day, 5-6 days per week, barely having enough time to take care of her own kids. And when she fell ill, she was not being able to be treated in the same hospital where she was helping others, because she had not the status of permanent resident. Being in that status, not being even a permanent resident, is like being in limbo.
Now, Premier François Legault says he's looking to halve the number of asylum seekers in Quebec. He says that they, along with temporary migrants like international students and temporary foreign workers, are to blame for problems like the housing crisis. Andrés Fontesilla, MNA with Quebec Solidaire for Laurier Dorion, says the problems with housing existed long before the latest wave of migration and are hitting parts of Quebec with little to no immigrant population.
L'immigration n'est pas la cause de la crise du logement. Cette crise-là existe depuis longtemps. Et bien avant les dernières vagues migratoires. D'ailleurs, il y a une crise du logement partout au Québec, même là où il n'y a pas d'immigration.
Fontesilla says putting the blame on migrants allows Legault to close the borders, but doesn't offer real solutions to the housing crisis.
C'est facile de dire ça parce que en mettant la faute sur les immigrants, le gouvernement, François Legault, le gouvernement de la CAQ, n'a plus besoin de régler la crise du logement. Il a réglé une crise d'immigration. Et ça, c'est une autre chose. Et comment on règle une crise d'immigration? Dans la tête de François Legault, on ferme les frontières.
Asylum seekers are caught in this rhetoric as well, of course, because he says that there's too many coming through the border already and that Quebec has no capacity to welcome all these people, these persons that are seeking refuge. But in reality, this is not true. We have community organizations who are experts in this job. There is a lack of political will, and this is what we're seeing right now. This is the landscape that we're seeing right now. And it is basically affecting our society because it is dividing us, while it should be the contrary, right?
This is Julia Tischer from the TCRI, a table de concertation or community roundtable made up of over 150 groups supporting migrants. She says that the government's turn against refugees is in more than just rhetoric, and that in the past year, Quebec's immigration ministry has begun to deny sponsorship applications shared between an organization and private citizens.
So there's two programs. There's one that is federal, the federal sponsorship program, and the provincial sponsorship program. And the provincial is it's actually the provincial government that is changing their interpretation in regard to the co-guarantors that organizations have been working with. The co-guarantors are family members of refugees who would like to sponsor their family members. Usually it's their family members, but there's others. And so the government doesn't want organizations to work with the family members anymore. So what we're seeing right now is that several dossiers are going to be stalled or possibly rejected because of this change in the rules.
Tischer says that by working together, a family might offer a room while an organization could take care of the paperwork. Or a community organization could connect someone with services, but a citizen might be there to show them around. Now, she says, the government is taking away that kind of a partnership.
All they're doing is they're collaborating with people that would not otherwise have access to the program. And they're doing this actually in the best possible way because they have experience, they have all that it takes to assure that the refugees are in the best hands.
Rojas, meanwhile, says that this turn away from migration isn't unique, but it is short-sighted.
Those refugees, asylum seekers, permanent residents, temporary foreign workers, they are the ones that are going to be taking care of the Quebecois at the Canadian later when we are the maison de retraite, the hospice. The hospitals, they will become the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, the future of the country.
A spokesperson from the Ministry of Immigration, Francization and Integration did not immediately give comment when reached by CKUT. I'm Jules Pigeon. Thanks for listening.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
To Ontario, where an initiative led by the Community Healthcare in Kitchener-Waterloo has resulted in the region's first consistent pay-what-you-can food market. Stemming from the organization's integrated strategy around supportive healthcare, the market is part of the Community Health and Wellness Program, which also includes a weekly breakfast club, cooking skill shares, and other capacity and community-building initiatives. While the market has been stocking its shelves since January through donations and the Second Harvest Food Rescue app, the project is teaming up with community gardens to bring in more fresh produce. Located in Kitchener, the market is open to everyone from 9 to 5 Monday through Thursday, and on Fridays from 8 to 4. Journalist Dan Keller spoke with Megan Vanderhook, a food program worker at Community Health Caring Kitchener-Waterloo.
How do you get the food for the market? I saw the call out for community gardens, but obviously that's a seasonal thing. How will you be stocking the market?
So what we've come to know is that it's not about there not being enough food out in our communities, it's about redistributing that food. So we have been using apps like Second Harvest, for example, to rescue, I think we've rescued over 27,000 meals in the last year, to rescue meals that would go in the garbage, in the waste, and bring them to our market. So we use food app, Second Harvest. We also just have other community connections, different groups who have actually started reaching out to us to drop off donations, as well as connections with other, you know, grocery stores, farmers in the area who are interested in our program and excited about donating to us. So yeah, a lot of sort of grassroots work within our community to get these donations here.
Now with community gardens, as we go into gardening season, I saw a call out that came across the news desk of linking with community gardens and the Pay What You Can market. How is that working out?
So it's actually been working out wonderful. We actually had an individual come drop off some of their fresh herbs from their garden, their community garden, last week. We have someone coming to drop off rhubarb. So it not only provides sort of a space for surplus produce to go, if that is the case for individuals with a community garden, but it draws connection and it allows them to know that this is maybe something that they can offer to their community and it's going to a cause or a meaningful organization for them. So it's sometimes it will be us picking up the donation. Other times it will be individuals dropping it off here. But so far it's been wonderful. I've had a huge influx of emails and interest from community gardens around the region. So it's been huge to really take advantage of the growing season.
How does this market fit in with Healthcaring KW's larger mission?
So Healthcaring KW's larger mission is really to respond to individuals in our community, their different needs surrounding health, wellness, mental health, physical health, whatever that may be. We're also about building community, right? So it's really been an opportunity for us to fit within that model of building community and doing that through food. So we do that through healthcare, we do that through our other programming, but also adding on top of that, doing that through food. So we also have monthly food pop-ups. So once a month, we try and serve a meal for individuals, which is also part of our food program, and individuals can come and enjoy that food here. And then also just leaving space for individuals to access food in a way where we're not asking for identification, their name, things like that, but it is a low barrier program for people.
The model isn't charity. Why have you decided to go with the Pay What You Can model?
I think for the Pay What You Can model, we've seen it directly with some of our individuals using the market themselves, that they really feel dignified and respected and cared for and using this type of a model. There's lots of research in the UK recently that the Pay What You Can process has been working quite well, and it's really diminishing the common feelings of shame, guilt, or judgment surrounding using a food access point, and also creating a space where all individuals are welcome, right? Not just those that are low income or may need this, but be having an opportunity for us to meet and connect over food and in a space where, yeah, we all need food, right? It is a human right at the end of the day, so.
How does this program work in collaboration, or not, I suppose, with other programs in the region, like the Laurier Student Market or the Pay What You Can Tiny Takeout in downtown Kitchener?
In terms of collaboration, when we have our monthly food pop-ups, we communicate with other organizations, food access organizations in the region, just to let them know about it, see if anyone from their programs may be interested in a second meal that day or whatever it may be. And then also we have I have created a food systems map, which shows other food access programs within the region that are in walking distance or further than that, and they're listed out with their time, dates. So we also offer those to our community members that are coming in to access the market.
Is that like an online map you keep updated?
So it's not online. We only have a paper copy version. It's something we're looking on getting up and into our website.
For folks who have used this program, what has the response been?
It's been a very positive response. I've actually had several conversations with community members who have used it, and they come up with their own process of how they can pay and they can contribute, and they feel really good about that. So one individual let me know that for every item they take, they contribute 10 cents for that item. And that was a process and budgeting that they came up with all on their own. So it's been really unique to see that experience for people. And also with our food pop-ups and our food programs, people have said, you know, this feels like I'm eating with family. And that is really what we're trying to do here, right? Create a community around food and connect around food, even if there's differences or barriers or whatever that may be. So yeah, we've had an overwhelmingly positive feedback, which has been really amazing.
Is it a model of something that could be expanded to even create a parallel systems of support, something like this at a larger model?
Yeah. So. And we definitely recognize, yeah, right, that this isn't necessarily a fix, but I also do believe that this type of a program in our center is very unique in that it does draw in connection and community building and placemaking, right? A place where people know your name is a huge part of what we do here. So, yeah, I think there's something unique about it.
At the end of the interview, Megan Vanderhook brought the conversation back to food insecurity.
I'll just add that in terms of us responding to food insecurity, we've really come to understand that responding to food insecurity is about access. It's also about responding to the physical and mental health implications of experiencing food insecurity. And we've also begun to understand that access looks different, and it can mean a whole lot of different things, right? It can be access in terms of getting to our location itself, but it can also be accessible food. So what I mean by accessible food is food that can be eaten right there, food that can be eaten maybe without a kitchen or without it needing to be cooked, and still getting nutritious, culturally appropriate food, whatever it may be, or if you have specific dietary needs, and just also having the choice and preference of what food you like, what food you don't like. So that's really what we're aiming to do here in terms of responding to food insecurity.
You have been listening to an interview with Megan Vanderhook, a food program worker at Community Healthcare in Kitchener-Waterloo, who discussed the Pay What You Can food market and the organization's efforts to support safer and healthier communities through food.
Thanks to Dan Keller for that story. And on a similar subject, Derek Bullard in Sherbrooke, Quebec, posted on frequencynews.ca a story about a European app that is trying to fight food waste. Too Good To Go, a mobile app combating food waste, has announced a partnership with convenience store chain Couche-Tard to include its stores on the platform. This expansion will enable Sherbrooke residents to purchase surplus food at a reduced price, furthering efforts to reduce food waste. In addition to this partnership, Too Good To Go has introduced the Look, Smell, Taste initiative. This program encourages consumers to use their senses to evaluate food quality before discarding items, aiming to decrease household food waste. Derek Bullard in Sherbrooke, Quebec, spoke with Quebec PR spokesperson Nicholas Dott.
With a lot of excitement, we were able to launch this week a new initiative that is called Look, Smell, Taste, and it's partnering with manufacturers and suppliers across the country. We have around 15 that, agreed to join the initiative right from the start. And basically the aim of this initiative is to tackle food waste at home and encourage, consumers like you and me to just trust your senses before you throw out a food that is past its best in 4 days. So that's going to take the form of a small label that is going to be printed on the packaging of, some food items to have, a best before date, some ice creams, for example, or some dairy products or candies, those kind of products that actually are really good past the date, as long as you store them properly and, that are unopened. And doing that is really an initiative and another way to just give a tool to consumer to, reduce their food waste at home.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Boris Chassang.
Two years years after Roe v. Wade was overturned in the United States, people gathered outside a Nanaimo courthouse on Monday, June 24th, to bring attention to the current state of reproductive rights in Canada. Strikes took place across Canada and the United States as a way to recognize the need to continue fighting for reproductive rights. Strike organizer and clinical counselor Stephanie Peter said that there is still much work to do in terms of pay equity, safety, and equality for women. She says she is worried that it seems like the rights of women are going backwards. Journalist Lauren McKenzie talked with Peter and Patty Dyer. They both said they joined the women's rights movement later in life after witnessing events such as the overturn of Roe v. Wade, taking away rights from women in the United States.
On the second anniversary of Roe v. Wade being overturned in the United States, almost 100 people gathered outside the Nanaimo Courthouse on Monday, June 24th, to strike for better rights for autonomy over women's bodies and existence. The gathering in Nanaimo was a part of a women's strike happening across Canada and the United States, recognizing the need to continue fighting for reproductive rights. In 2022, Roe v. Wade was overturned, ending the legal case from 1973 that saw the U.S. Supreme Court rule 7-2 that the restriction of abortion services by state regulation was unconstitutional. An Nanaimo strike organizer and clinical counselor Stephanie Peter told the crowd that while the overturn of Roe v. Wade may only affect those in the U.S., it is important to pay attention to what is happening in Canada.
There's still so much further that we need to go in terms of pay equity, in terms of safety, in terms of equality. And to see that it's going in the wrong direction is deeply, deeply worrying and upsetting. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're all here today.
Sarah Cameron, a local health worker and 2S LGBTQIA+ advocate, also spoke at the strike. Cameron, who is a transgender woman, shared what she noticed through her gender transition. She said until her transition, she was only able to experience the perspective of being a woman from the point of view of someone perceived to be a man. She says it wasn't until her transition that she started to notice and understand the inequalities that all women face.
Sometimes now I'm talked over by colleagues a lot more than I used to be. It never used to happen, in fact. My work is sometimes questioned. That never used to happen. This never happened that way before. I have unwanted advances from men sometimes at work or randomly when I'm just minding my own business.
She says in the United States, women, including transgender women, are losing more rights to what they can do with their bodies.
This is a concern for everyone, a sign of things to come for all women. The removal of trans rights has been a testing of our tolerance for the removal of rights. And we saw this in the U.S. with the right to choose now taken away. So could this happen here in Canada? Yes.
Cameron says there has been similar shifts in societal acceptance happening in Canada, and it is time for people to recognize what's happening in the United States could happen in Canada as well. She says it's important to pay attention to local politics and school board trustees and board elections, even if, as she says, it seems obscure or pointless. She points out a former school board trustee in Chilliwack who had strong anti-SOGI, or sexual orientation and gender identities, views on the curriculum that teaches kids about sexual orientation and gender identities.
The good news is that this man is a former school board trustee. He tried to get reelected, but folks organized to make sure that didn't happen. So we can take action and we can make a real difference.
After the speeches, CHOY spoke with Stephanie Peter and Patty Dyer about the strike. Peter says she's only recently gotten into the women's movement and the fight for reproductive rights, although she has experienced sexism and misogyny all throughout her life.
Since I was a teenager, I've become aware of misogyny. I've become aware of you know, feeling like a second-class citizen, feeling like there's things I can't do, and butting up against that and finding it really frustrating and irritating because there's no logical reason for it. But I didn't get involved.
She says it wasn't until Roe v. Wade was overturned that she got involved in the movement.
You know, that's been there since 1973. I'm in my 60s now, so my entire reproductive life, I've known that abortion was legal in the States and at least not illegal in Canada.
Dyer also came into the movement later in life.
I mean, I've been led by example, and I've certainly been vocal, but I have not been an activist. I have not been someone who's on the forefront. But I really do feel like times are changing, and I need to become more so that you know, so this opportunity came at the right time that I think we are at a turning point. And so I think it is really important that we do start to stand up and we do start to speak out more publicly.
Peter says the strike is to raise awareness of the three main topics: bodily autonomy and reproductive rights, stopping gender-based violence, and gender equal rights for women.
You know, there's still only 30% of the people in decision-making positions of power in Canada are women, and 6% women of color. So, you know, those are really disappointing stats. We should be much further ahead than that.
She also points out the gender pay gap across the country that differs in size in each province and territory. According to the BC government, in 2022, women were paid 17% less than men, with an average hourly salary for men being $35.50 per hour compared to $29.53 per hour for women. It also found that Indigenous, racialized, and immigrant women had an even lower average wage. New pay transparency legislation that came into effect on November 1st of last year requires all publicly advertised jobs to include wage or salary ranges. Peter tells CHOY that while there are reproductive rights across the country, the situation is different from province to province.
I'd say we're pretty lucky in BC. For instance, when it comes to abortion, we have access to abortion for the first 25 weeks of pregnancy. In New Brunswick, they have access for the first 13. Most women don't know they're pregnant until they're about 6 weeks pregnant. So that gives you 7 weeks in which to get an appointment and to go through the wait list and to be served. And that's not happening in New Brunswick. So women are leaving the province to have an abortion in New Brunswick.
Currently in BC, abortions are available in the province and are covered for residents under the Medical Service Plan. In February of this year, Action Canada for Sexual Health and Rights made a statement saying the New Brunswick government's lack of funding for surgical abortions outside of a hospital setting is forcing community abortion clinics to close. Currently in New Brunswick, there are only 3 hospitals that can offer abortion services up to 13 weeks. The closure of community abortion clinics could then lead to longer wait lists to access the services in the province, which would end up being a wait time longer than 13 weeks. Peter, whose daughter was in attendance at the strike, says it's important to protect the current abortion rights so the future generation will still have access to them. She says as the provincial election is coming up this year and the federal election will be happening next year, it's important to pay attention to candidates and what they stand for.
When you add up the number of women, non-binary, and trans Canadians, it's almost 20 million. That's a lot of votes. I think that that if we act in our own best interests and we can communicate and discuss and share information, then that's one big thing that we can do.
Dyer adds that it's important to continue being engaged with the movement and continue having conversations about the current state of reproductive and women's rights across the country and in the United States. This is Laura McKenzie.
And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists Dan Keller, Derek Bullard, Lauren McKenzie, and Jules Bugiel. National editors Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and your local radio station. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for being here this week, and until the next, have fun. Ciao.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.